Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. I'm Dr. Marty Gentius for Counselor Audio Source, and this week, Dr. Adina Renfro-Michel of Montclair State University interviews Dr. Saki Holdenis regarding forensic interviewing of child sexual abuse cases.
Welcome, Dr. Holdenis, to CounselorAudioSource.net.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
We're here to talk a little bit about forensic interviewing. Could you please define that term?
Well, the forensic interview is basically information that is gathered using an investigative approach when there is suspected child abuse or if a child may have witnessed a violent crime. So it's a very controlled way, a very sterile way of gathering information.
What are some of the goals of forensic interviewing?
Well, of course, one goal is to obtain the information necessary to determine if a crime has been committed or if a child has been traumatized in any way, but several secondary goals in this interviewing process. You want to minimize trauma to the child. Minor children represent a very vulnerable population and must be protected. Of course, some trauma cannot be avoided. The interview itself, no matter how kind or gentle we try to be, just discussing events that occur can be traumatic. And then sometimes you have the trauma of a medical exam where the child or the teenager has to undergo a rape kit. And this is something where the child can feel violated all over again. You want to maximize the quality and the quantity of the information that's provided by the child, and at the same time maintain the integrity of the investigative process so that it does pass judicial scrutiny. For example, you want to avoid any leading questions. Leading questions are questions that can lead a child to certain responses. And of course, the defense, if this becomes a legal case, the defense will attempt to prove the child's testimony is contaminated as a result of how the information was obtained.
So you have to do it in a completely controlled environment.
Yes, the room itself is very child-friendly, and then on the other side of the room is another room with a one-way mirror. It's the electronic room where they can actually see me working with the child. They have the video equipment there. I have four cameras in my room that are hidden from view. Oftentimes the astute child can pick those cameras out, which is no problem. Sometimes I even point them out to a child. It's not anything to be deceptive. Two of them are hidden among stuffed animals and two are hidden among plants. So we have a four-angled view at all times possible. And then sometimes the Department of Human Services, Family Services has a representative there. Sometimes there is legal representation and sometimes law enforcement is there. And I wear an earbud and they can ask me or tell me the information that they are seeking, and then I will put that in such a way to the child that maintains the integrity of the interview process.
What do you do when police officers are asking leading questions that you are unable to ask the child?
They have no problem asking leading questions. It's their style of interviewing oftentimes, and they will often cue me to ask something, ask the child, you know, this, this, or that, and that's a leading format. And sometimes they will repeat, ask them this question, and I'll say, I can't do that, that's leading. And they'll say, we don't care, and they really don't care, but the legal umbrella does care. So I'm responsible for the delivery of the questions in such a manner so that the child generates the answers from nothing that I have said, but only what I have asked.
Could you give me an example of a leading question that a police officer might ask you and how you might rephrase that for the child?
Okay. I've had police officers to ask if the perpetrator or the alleged perpetrator removed their panties, and I would ask in such a way as, what happened next? What happened next? What happened next? What were you wearing? Describe the clothes you were wearing. And not mention any specific article. Did he come into the bedroom? That's leading. It almost gives the answer, yes, he came into the bedroom. And I would say, well, where were you and where was he? Or just very open-ended questions so that I don't have any lead-in as to this particular response.
Thank you. We talked about who's in the room watching. Who's in the room with you when you're doing these interviews?
99% of the cases, it is only myself and the child. The parents are not allowed, even in the electronic room. I have made one exception to that because the child that I was interviewing had a speech impediment, and I could not understand the answers, but the mother could. So I would ask the question. The child would give the answer. They would cue me back into my earbud what the answer was so that I could continue on with the next question. And then another time, I had law enforcement with me during the interview because the child, the little boy, had already bonded with the policeman, and they had become buddies. And it was very easy to have that interview with the policeman there with the child. I didn't have to work on so much the child repeating his story. I never know who the child has already told. I like to get the child just as quickly as possible before everybody has had to listen to his story separately. Sometimes the child will tell a teacher or a parent, and then they call DHS, they get that interview, then they may call a lawyer in, then they may try to get law enforcement in, and eventually it comes to me so that we can do a video of the child. And we're trying to educate DHS and law enforcement and all of the other interdisciplinary team members to come to me first if at all possible. And then they will have access to the information firsthand if they can attend the interview as well.
What is the purpose in you being the first one that the child tells the story to?
Makes it a lot cleaner. Oftentimes when a child is telling their story and they have to repeat it, they will leave out parts because they think that they already said that, so why say it again? And then a lot of times children will say, I've already told so-and-so. I don't want to tell it again. And it's hard to get them to, well, I don't know, I didn't, please, you know, let me know that I wasn't there and I didn't get to hear. And it's tough because children oftentimes do not want to tell it and retell it.
And is it true that often children who tell a story, the next time they tell it, they'll leave details out because they've already said that to someone else?
Exactly.
So this way you get as much detail as possible and as much accuracy as possible?
That's right, because my style of interviewing, children will probably think I am the dumbest person that they have ever met because I do a lot of I don't understand, or would you tell me again, I didn't quite get, and I have them repeat. And there's two reasons why I have the children to repeat their story, even through the process. You know, we go through the whole thing and we go backtrack and get more information sometimes when they are repeating something that they've already said, they will add details. And other times it just shows how credible their story is that they do basically tell the same thing. Because if they're making it up as they go along, and I've been asked in court, do children lie? Yes, children have been known to lie. It is unusual that they lie, as why would anybody lie about this? But there are reasons, and they do, and we do have to make sure their story is credible as much as possible.
So the more detail you have and the less people the child has told the story to, the more credible your interview.
That's true in part. The more detail you have, that is true. But I also look for something kind of just off the wall or off the cuff, a little piece of, you know, serendipity or a little golden nugget that makes me think this is something that actually occurred. Like, while this was going on, what was going through your mind? What were you thinking? And one child said, I just watched the fan, the ceiling fan, go around and around and around until it was over.
Wow. So when you're conducting an interview, how do you begin the interview with the child?
Well, of course, the interview begins the moment I approach the child. And I usually try to dress child friendly, like I have, you know, cow dresses and cow buttons. And I try to dress child friendly, not in a suit. And I carry with me a real large, floppy-eared rabbit that I have hanging over my arm. And I walk up to them and I introduce Miss Bunny to them and ask them if they would like to come with me. And we're going to play. Miss Bunny and I are going to take you to a really neat room where we're going to play together. Sometimes they just come right on with me. Other times they want the mother or the parent to accompany them. If I say, no, Mama can't come, this is a kids' room only, kids only, Miss Bunny and you and me, and that's it. And if they fret further, then we let Mama walk down the hall through a lounge area and go that far. And we say, this is where Mama's going to wait, but we go on from here to the playroom. Don't usually have a problem with them separating if we take it that far. They'll go right on into the room because by that time they can see into the room. We walk down the hall and they can see the room. The room is real child friendly, lots of stuffed animals around, and we walk in that room and we walk around and we look at all the stuffed animals, and I ask them if they want to pick one out to hold while we talk, and they usually pick one out. I have a snake that's hanging across one of the shelves, and I've only had one child to pick a snake and wrap it around its neck while he talks with me. Everybody else will choose a bear or, you know, a frog or something. It's a comforting object to hold while we talk. And then we sit down a little, there's a couch for the older children that we sit and visit on for adolescents. But then for the smaller children, there's a little child-sized table with two child-sized chairs. One is a little larger than the other. And I let the child sit in the big chair, and then I sit in the small chair.
What is your purpose for having the children sit in the large chair?
Well, it makes them feel bigger, and it helps me to have an eye contact that's more parallel with the child rather than me looking down on the child and them looking up at me. I want an even power if I can. So that child is looking straight across from me because I'm lower. That's my goal, is to be very, very child-friendly. Well, let me speak just a moment about prior information. When people are bringing me a child, whether it's law enforcement or whether it's DHS or the parent, I find that there is a propensity to tell me everything they know. And I have to stop them and say, I only want the child's name. If there are any special handicaps or considerations I need to know, the chronological age, which helps me with the developmental age, and who is bringing the child in, who is accompanying the child. Some people want basic information regarding the allegation, but I don't. I want to go in with very minimal information. When the child comes into the room and we sit and talk, the very first thing I have to do is assess credibility, the level of credibility, to make sure that this child can come across as an effective witness and have a real clear testimony. So I will just start out by asking their name, their age. Sometimes they have to just show me their fingers. They're 4, 3, or 4, 5, and I count the fingers. I ask them who brought them there to the facility. I ask them who lives in their home, if there's any siblings, if there's a father, a mama, a daddy, find out who's in the home. They can tell me this. And, of course, we check for accuracy later. What school they go to, what grade they're in, their teacher's name, favorite subject, just to get them to talking, just to be comfortable with exchanging information back and forth. Then I also have to assess whether or not the child knows the difference between a truth and a lie. I will say something that is the truth. I'm wearing a white shirt. And is that a truth or a lie? And they'll say. And then I'll say something that is not true, and I'll say, is that a truth or a lie? And they'll say, that's a lie. And so then I'll say, well, I'm going to be asking you some more questions today, and I only want you to tell me the truth. If you do not know the answer, you do just tell me you don't know. if you don't want to answer me, if you don't want to respond, then you can say, I pass, and that will be okay. I will skip that question, but I'll probably come back to it later. And do you know I've not had any children use that? They may say, I don't know. And that is either true or not true. And I have to ascertain whether or not I feel like they do know or they do not know. And then we go into the deeper part of the interview where it's the real information gathering. And I try to start out by saying, do you know why you're here? Now, again, that's a controversial question. Some interviewers do not like that question, but I find it is a wonderful segue into the core of the interview, because so many times they will say, yes, I know why I'm here. It is because Uncle Joe, blah, 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 and off we go into it. And I say, well, can you tell me more about it? If they don't know why they're here, then I will go into an explanation as to why they possibly might be here. Did anything happen to you that you didn't like and you told someone? Something very, very general. And there are times when I get nothing, absolutely nothing, and we close. And then there are other times when the evidence speaks for itself, so we know something has occurred, pretty, pretty confident, and all we need to know are the details of it. And I had one child who, no matter what I asked her, I don't remember. I don't remember. I flopped around with her for about 45 minutes, which is lengthy in working with a child, and I tried every angle I knew. And if we had not had the evidence backing up something that had happened, I would have given up, and I was about to give up anyway. And I thought, well, I'll just try one more time. And I think by this time I had her in my lap, which is something I have to be very careful about doing, because they've been violated with touch, so I have to be careful not to touch the children. But this was one where you use your intuition and decide whether or not the child needs to be comforted in that way or it would help. And so I did have her sitting in my lap, and we were, you know, playing with her fingers and just still talking, and I asked her something, you know, yet again, another way, and she said, I don't remember. And I said, but if you did remember, what would you remember? And it was the key that unlocked her story. It was amazing. She started talking, and it was like, almost like a projective technique, like pretend you remember. And she started telling what happened. And I just knew that everybody in the control room had fallen asleep. And I wanted to just say, are we getting this? Are we rolling tape? Oh, wakey, wakey in there. She's talking. And it was almost like we were all, you know, popped up like pieces of toast from the toaster. We're rolling, she's talking, and it was just one of those things. You know, you got to find the key to unlock the language.
How do you determine how much detail the child would be able to give you?
That is oftentimes a developmental ability of language. And when a child has, especially the younger children who are limited in their language ability, if they have given me any information at all, that leads me to believe that something inappropriate has taken place. And this is very important. They have already disclosed some information leading me to believe something happened. Then at that point, I will bring out the anatomical dolls. I have four from different nationalities, and I will match that nationality to the child. The child will help me pull out each doll, and we will look at the dolls, and we will talk about, they'll start naming the part of the body, from the hair to the eyes to the nose to the mouth to the ears, and then we go into the, you know, the arms and the legs, and then we go into the private parts, and I get the child's name for their private parts, like what do you call this, what is it for, so we get the name of the private part and we get the function of the private part, and then from that point on I use the child's language. Like one child kept telling me, my daddy touched my bird, my daddy touched my bird, and touched my bird, and I thought, oh, okay, and I really just didn't know even how to comment. But when we moved into the part of the interview where I pulled out the dogs and we were going over that, when she touched her private area, and I said, what do you call this? She says, that's my bird. So then it became real clear what had been happening with her. Their language is definitely key to understanding their story.
All right, so it sounds like it's not just a matter of getting details, but of understanding from their point of view their language and how much they are able to communicate.
Exactly. And it just reiterates in picture form, very concrete form, with the children that can use these dolls. Once they have told me what happened, I said, can you show me using the dolls? Show me so that I will understand what happened to you. You told me, now can you show me? And they will show me. We'll undress the dolls so that they're eventually naked. And then they'll show me. It's pretty graphic. And then we can move into, when this happened to you, how did you feel? What was going on? And, you know, trying to use developmentally appropriate language with those children.
So now that you have gathered all of the information that you feel you're able to get from the child, how do you close that interview?
One thing I do is we go back and repeat everything, and I ask them if there's anything that they can remember that they would like to tell me that I didn't know to ask. And sometimes that will generate yet another piece of information. And I will thank them for sharing their story and tell them that I'm so proud of them for telling. If they told, sometimes it was a situation where the person was caught and they did not tell. But if they told and they finally told someone, then I'll find out, you know, who they told and congratulate them on telling. And I'll say it's part of my job to make sure this does not happen to you again. But if anything else ever happens like this where someone touches you and you don't like it, who will you tell? Who can you tell that you trust to tell? And they'll tell me. And I'll say that's good. You make sure you tell. I try to set the stage for helping them or empowering them to be able to handle it again without being abused. Sometimes it goes on for quite a while before it comes to light. And then I ask them if they have any questions for me, that I have asked them a lot of questions, and thank them again, and do they have any questions for me. And usually they do not have questions for me, but I did have one sweet little cherub of a child. He was about 3 years old. And he'd done a phenomenal job of talking about what had happened to him. And when I asked him if he had any questions for me, he looked up at me, and I could see the tears just boiling up out of his eyes. And he looked at me and he said, am I going to jail? And I thought, all this time, this child, he is in trouble for what happened to him. And we never know what a perpetrator has threatened them with. So I had to assure him that he would not be going to jail. Sad what we discover goes through their little minds.
Yes. Especially at that age, because their thinking is so illogical.
And they do have some concept of jail, you know, from television. And who knows, the perpetrator could say, you know, if you tell, you'll be in trouble because you will have done something wrong and they will take you to jail. If they take me to jail, they'll take you to jail too. And a three-year-old would not know any different.
Exactly. Saki, you said that a lot of times a child is not the one that tells. What are some reasons why children don't tell?
Well, one of the reasons is out of fear. The perpetrator has threatened them in some way. They threaten to harm them, kill them, harm a sibling, kill a pet, threaten them with jail, that they'll be in trouble, that someone will not love them anymore if they find out. Other children will not tell because somehow or another they have figured out that the relationship they have with the perpetrator is in some way special and unique, and it's their secrets. And they've been told to keep the secrets. And that is one of the things that we talk about in the interview. Has anyone ever told you to keep a secret and not tell? And this is a room where all the secrets can be told. And sometimes they have been told to keep a secret, and sometimes that's not a part of the language. I had a very young teenager, about 13, who was being molested by her mother's boyfriend. He was keeping this child after school until mother came home from work, and he was engaging in sexually inappropriate behavior with her. And she did not tell because he was getting her favors. He was letting her drive his car around the property, which was a wonderful thing to her. She loved it. And he would give her money, and she liked having the money. So because of that, it was like a payoff for her. She didn't want her mother to know because she wanted to continue driving, and she liked the money. And this was one of the situations where her mother came home early one afternoon and literally caught them. And that's how that story unfolded.
Dr. Holden, this, you just spoke about how one of the perpetrators was the mother's boyfriend. Who are the perpetrators of sexual abuse with children?
A perpetrator can be anyone, known or unknown to the child. We talk about stranger danger, but we actually need to put more emphasis on inappropriate behaviors rather than people. Because a perpetrator can be male or female, a family member, a stepmother, stepfather, friends, parents of friends, brothers, sisters, friends of brothers or sisters, neighbors, babysitters, child care workers, clergy members, scout leaders, Sunday school teachers, health professionals, doctors, attorneys, even mental health professionals. No one is eliminated from the possibility of being a perpetrator. People that we think we can trust, we may not can trust. Look at the information that is coming out now over the last several decades on the molestation by the priests. And these children were taught to respect and honor the Catholic priest and that they could do no wrong and whatever they did was okay. And their stories are coming out now that they were taught to trust the clergy. And yet I've had one person tell me that they were being molested in church, during church, by one of the deacons.
We should be careful how we tell our children about trust and definitely define safe touch to them.
Exactly.
What's the most surprising thing that has happened to you during your time of doing forensic interviews?
Well, let's see. I remember one afternoon I was being interviewed by a magazine, can't remember the name of the magazine, but they had brought in a photographer to take pictures of me with my work with the anatomical dogs. And in this facility, we have a daycare center. So we thought it would be neat just to have a child sitting in the chair with me, and you could see maybe the back of his head and then me working with the dogs with the child. So we thought that would be good for the magazine. So we pulled the child out of the daycare center and instructed the photographer to just get maybe the back of his head. He was just kind of walking around taking pictures of different angles. And I had the dog pulled out, and this kid was just so cute. It was after lunch. He had spaghetti all over his shirt, and he was just a cute little thing. And I just automatically went into autopilot. My dogs were in front of me, so I was talking about the dogs and private parts and touching and all of this, and just kind of going into my automatic field. And he started disclosing how somebody, a friend of his brother, older brothers or somebody, had been touching his little weenie and he didn't like it. And I thought, wait, hang on. Stop taking these pictures. We've got to get another camera. Wait, no more pictures. And I thought, okay, don't hyperventilate. Don't overreact. This guy was still moving around the room, snapping and clicking. And I'm thinking, stop the press. We have got to get this child on tape. And I ended up doing a proper interview with him. But I'm thinking, this child was in our daycare facility and was being molested, and we didn't know it. Scary. That was a big surprise for me.
Very scary, since y'all were trained to recognize it and still didn't see it.
Exactly. And maybe no signs. Who knows? Were there any signs? I don't know. They don't always hold up red flags.
This is true.
Adina, you had asked me about children who do not tell, why they don't tell.
Yes.
And I said a lot of times it's fear. I had an adult come to me for therapy who had been abused, sexually molested by her father. And I'm always interested in why a child does not tell or why a child does tell and the difference between the two. A lot of factors going on, but one of the things that she disclosed to me as an adult was when she was a child and her father was molesting her, she got into some medical problems. I think she started bleeding and it was very traumatic. And the father knew that he had to take her to the emergency room to get some help. And in driving to the emergency room, he instructed her to tell the doctors she did this to herself using a bottle, if you could follow me on this.
Okay.
So when they got to the emergency room, they closed the curtains around her and they repeatedly asked her how the damage had occurred. And she kept saying, I did it with a bottle. I did it with a bottle. And she said, I couldn't tell them the truth because under the curtains I could see my daddy's feet.
Wow.
So she was not able to feel safe enough to tell.
After the forensic interview, where does the child go next?
That depends on the perpetrator. And if the perpetrator is in the home, sometimes the perpetrator is removed from the home. Sometimes the child is removed from the home.
So if a child is removed from the home, are they going to continue to receive counseling services?
Sometimes they do. Sometimes they will continue to see me through in a therapeutic setting. But I have people who come to me from other surrounding states, so I don't have access to them for follow-up therapy. They go back to their home. Because I have people coming to me from all over the state and then into other states as well. So I don't have the opportunity to always follow up with counseling. I have recently picked up a client who was telling me that she was molested by her father about 10 years ago. She's an adult now, it happened as a child, and that she had been interviewed. And as we talked, I figured out that it was a very good possibility I did the interview. And we talked about that, and she said, well, I did look familiar. And we're talking 10 years ago, and she was a child of only about 7 or 8 at the time. And it's been about 10 or 12 years. And so we tried to find her tape. She wanted to watch the tape of the forensic interview. She thought that would be very therapeutic for her to pick that back up. And we were not able to locate that tape. We don't know if it was destroyed because of the years it has been or what, but interesting. She's just now getting the therapy that she needed. I lost her after the interview.
If you had been able to find the tape, what do you think that would have done for your client?
It would have been interesting, and I would have been in new territory because I've never had that happen. It could have been potentially quite powerful because she has arrested in her development. There's a lot of work that needs to be done because she did not get the help she needed back when she was a child and then as a teenager and now as a young adult. And there's been a lot of cleanup work that could have been initiated beginning with that tape. Because this particular person did not tell. She was afraid. She was threatened with death, and she was not going to tell. But a witness told. Feel powerless. Children feel very powerless against adults.
All right, and so one of the things that you do in your interviewing is to try to help them feel more powerful.
Hopefully. That certainly is a goal, and that's why we talk about trying to name someone that they can trust, that they will go to and tell.
How long do the interviews usually last?
Anywhere from about 30 minutes to 45 minutes. Past 45 minutes is pretty long.
Zach, since this has been a bit of a deep subject, a very serious subject, I'd like to end the interview with something a little bit lighter. Do you have a lighter story to tell us about something that happened during the interviews?
You're right. It is quite heavy, and it is quite sad that these things are happening to our innocent children. But even in the heaviness, there are lighter moments. And I can think of a couple. One of them, I had a hyperactive child, and they were pulling out every stuffed animal in the place, and I was doing everything I could to continue with the interview and at the same time come out of all of these drowning animals. I was stepping over my skirts. I was trying to conduct something that looked professional. They were all over me, and to look back, it looked like something out of one of the Lucy shows. And I thought, if this ever gets caught, I will lose my reputation. And I looked like I was just a frazzled piece of work that was not getting any work done, actually. The child was in total control of the room, and I looked completely at the child's mercy. And so there was a comedy of errors on that particular interview. And then I was closing with a little boy one day. He's about 3 years old. And one of the things that I like to do is I like for the children to remember my name. It's an unusual name, Stacky. And I ask them to repeat it and to remember it in case they ever want to see me again or they have something else that they remember they want to tell me. I wanted to know my name, so I was telling this little boy, said, "My name is Miss Stacky. Can you say that?" Or, and it's like a sack that you put marbles in or something. I think we may have been playing with a few marbles there on the table. And I said, "It's just like a sack that you would put these marbles in. So try to remember my name." So we'd gone through the interview. He'd done a wonderful job, and we were closing, and I thanked him. And I said, "Now, can you tell me my name? Do you remember?" And his eyes got so bright and the biggest smile on his face, and he said, "Miss Marble." Not quite. But so cute, so precious. It's a joy to work with these children.
Well, it was a joy to interview you today, Saki, and I really appreciate you helping to teach other counselors about forensic interviewing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've just heard a podcast with Dr. Saki Holdenis by Adina Renfro-Michelle of Montclair State University regarding forensic interviewing of child sexual abuse cases. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselorAudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4242. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.